Proper Sport at 6. You won't miss a minute, whether they matter or not.
Fire it, he's going to dummy, he's going to
win! Yes!
Curry's over the line. No, he isn't. He's lost the ball.
He's off.
He's gone.
Go on, Johnson.
This is the home of full match commentary. This is Rugby League on Radio Yorkshire.
Good evening and welcome. It's that time of week again, every Monday night, 6 until 8, 2 hours right here on Radio Yorkshire's. We look back at the Rugby League weekend. Castleford and Leeds have wrapped up home semi-finals, but the race is on to find out which two clubs will join them in the last four. Wakefield were denied by a last-gasp Johnny Lomax try, as Scott Grick's mistake left Wakefield with a mountain to climb. Scoey, well, he's not having Scott Grick's. He's not happy at all. We'll get the big fella's opinion on that. As Liam Watts sending off halted Hull's hopes for a top-four finish. No charges for the Hull man today. Congratulations to Warrington and Hull Kingston Rovers, who are back in Super League for 2018. But who will join them as the race to avoid the million-pound game really does hot up? Oh, and the small matter, we've got Nigel Wood, Chief Executive of the RFL, with us in the studio. Some of you might have already noticed on Twitter. You can get in touch at RL on RY. You can get in touch via the Radio Yorkshire Facebook page, facebook.com/Radio Yorkshire. You can listen online at radioyorkshire.co.uk. We're all set for action. What do you want to talk about? Let us know. The show where the listener sets the agenda.
Want your say on all things rugby league? Radio Yorkshire, every Monday, 6 to 8pm. Opinions welcome, but be prepared to fight your corner.
Welcome along, one and all. Thank you to everyone who's tweeted me over the weekend and sent my Twitter feed into delirium. I can confirm Mr. Nigel Wood is with us in the studio. Nigel, are you well?
I'm very well, thank you, Mark, and thank you for having me. I thought for a minute you weren't going to get me on here. I've tried so hard to get on, and at long last I managed to knock the door down and come and spend some time with you.
Good stuff. And for people that don't know, you did actually ask to come on, didn't you? I've not dragged you in, I've not kidnapped you or anything like that. You're here of your own free
will.
That's
a very faithful representation, yes.
Richard Shaw, right, the Wakefield top four bandwagon has just hit a little bump in the road. How's the confidence?
A little bump just where the ball just squirmed out of the grasp of Scott Grick's.
The unfortunate Scott. Yeah.
That wasn't the word I was using at 10 o'clock when watching that game
on
Thursday.
Rich,
no,
come
I can't
on,
use
Rich.
That word.
No, Rich, come on. Right, come on, then.
Rich,
come on then, because I've just been slaughtered a little bit by Mark Wilson and Phil Kaplan. You as a Wakefield fan, come on, what do you think about that howler which is going to cost Wakefield the top four spot?
It was a very bad mistake. There's not much more I can say.
It was a mistake?
Yeah.
What do you want him to do?
Was it the only one in the game?
He did set up that try earlier on for Bill Tupou when all the Saints players forgot how to run. That was quite good, but it's a game of inches. And
it is.
Unfortunately, Scott Grick's got it wrong on that occasion.
How much of his contribution this year has got Wakefield to be in the top four?
All right, I'll sling one out there for all the Wakefield fans. What's Don Fox remembered for? There you go, and then Grick's. Okay, doesn't matter how well you played, you're only as good as your last game. That ball should have been on the M62 motorway, on the back of a truck, going to Humberside. Simple as that.
There is a small matter, as I said to you outside.
Yeah, they ain't gonna
from
win,
the dropout, St Helens could still have scored.
Oh, listen, there were 90 seconds to go. Do me a favour, you're touching at scores.
As
I said, Mark Wilson, Phil Carr, as I said, grow some. Chickens, grow some. Just because we're not allowed to criticise players anymore.
You are allowed to criticise.
It's a howler. And it's cost Wakefield the top four spot. They ain't going to beat Hull. They ain't going to beat Wigan. There you go.
Oh,
wait, Nigel, anyway, okay.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
This is what we have to put up with every week.
You four carry on, it's pretty good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you had the slogan, every minute matters, a few years ago. This is a season where everything is going to go down to the wire, isn't it, in both the Super 8s and the qualifiers?
I think that's right. I think also it was in years one and two with the helicopter trying to decide where to land to present the league leaders and last year's million-pound game. And one of the attractions of this format is that it does provide equity long into the season. As we can't ask for more than having six teams playing for four places and still all that work on the million-pound game to avoid, as people said earlier on. It's terrific, really. I mean, it's edge-of-the-seat stuff.
Has this been a landmark weekend for the sport, do you think? Bearing in mind that Hull Cowra have got back into Super League and gone about things in an incredibly impressive manner. Toronto have been promoted and you asked them to prove themselves. They couldn't really have done any more getting 8,000 record crowd at their promotion party. If we look a bit further, wider in the world, PNG Hunters have made a grand final for the first time. Should we be celebrating this weekend?
Well, people in East Hull will be celebrating, that's for sure. I think that... I think it's overstating to say it's a landmark weekend. I think that you know, there have been other weekends where memorable things have taken place. You know, last season the £1 million game getting and Lee getting up, you know, proved the validity of the system. So I think there are other things around the world. Toronto, you're right. Toronto, it's an impressive performance in anybody's language. But I wouldn't get carried away. It's a landmark weekend. I think the sport has done a lot of things right for a period of time, and every now and then the stars align and the results fall a particular way, and we should celebrate. For that is for sure, because we're pretty good at not celebrating and actually beating ourselves up. So. We should if there's an opportunity.
If Lee were to get relegated and Hull Cowra were to come up, does that justify the concept, or are we just getting the yo-yo syndrome that we used to have with promotion and relegation?
Well, I remember when Lee came up in whatever it was, 2003 or 4, whenever it was, and by the time they'd lost three, they played the first six games, they didn't win another game. And if you listen to Derek, he'd tell you openly that they started planning for relegation because they knew they were a long way out. You know, early part of this season, Lee were looking to avoid being in that middle eight, and a couple of decisions went against them. They lost a couple of matches. They ran out of gas a little bit, so they're trapped in it. But I don't think, you know, I think it is very different.
The big question a lot of people have got, well, that's it. They've got a lot of questions for you, Nigel, as I can clarify all the tweets I got at the weekend when we said you were coming on. But people want to know, you're saying it's working. This is what, you know, the excitement. Is it going to change? That's what they want to know.
I think we said that we'd review it after three seasons, and that's what will happen. Rogers doing that is having a look at it, talking to the clubs. Because, of course, we built this model based upon, if you like, what we thought would happen, not would actually happen. So we've now got 3 years' worth of experience, and it's right that it's looked at. We've made an announcement already that there'll be no changes for 2018, any material changes. But after that, then we'll look at it again when Rogers done his work. I think that we have to... what this system does... undoubtedly is it, the reintroduction of Jeopardy is exciting for everybody. I think everybody who's perhaps not personally involved in it thinks it's just magnificent. The question we really have to ask, the real question is, has the reintroduction of that Jeopardy improved the revenues coming into the sport? If it's improved the revenues coming into the sport, well, then there's a very, very strong argument to continue. But if it's just Jeopardy for the sake of Jeopardy, then you have to ask whether it's counterproductive. And that's a complex piece of work. You know, Roger's going to look at that with the clubs at all levels, and we'll work on that over the next 12 months.
Because the subject again, Nigel, is franchising coming in, and... I, for one, certainly don't want franchising. I guess for two reasons. Certainly when you looked at a few years ago, Crusaders came in at the expense of Widnes, and then the Crusaders literally said they were in, and then 24 hours after they were out, we invited Wakefield back from there. But for me, with the franchise system, I just feel as though it just puts clubs and players in a comfort zone, to be honest with you, because there's not that added pressure of maybe this relegation.
And that was licensing, which was the name under which a franchise type system was run for two cycles of 3 years. And again, we said, and after 3 years, we'd look at that and decide whether it was delivering. And it had its own objectives. The objectives were: did we have more financial stability? Did we build new grounds? And did we produce more players than we thought we would otherwise do? And there wasn't enough evidence to suggest that the protection that having a locked-in league provided was good enough. We didn't build enough new grounds, because the only one that was really built was Salford. Saints built a ground because they built it anyway. They wanted to do that. The only ground that was substantially developed on the back of being given a licence was Salford. There was just as many insolvencies as there were beforehand, and we didn't produce any more or any less players. So I think the game as a whole celebrated the reintroduction of promotion and relegation, and I think that's probably something that we wouldn't want to let go under any circumstances.
Do you also have to protect part of your business model, though, bearing in mind that sport is a business these days? If Catalan were to get relegated, would that cause you to rethink the model?
Look, if Catalan get relegated, it's because they haven't been good enough over 10 months. And by the way, they've had 10 or 11 years to get the position in order. They've got the advantages of being a single country franchise, a bit like New Zealand. So they've got, they carry the hopes of a nation, and really that their performance over a period of time is a reflection of the, all the decisions they've taken over that period. So I don't think it caused me to, it's not an individual decision, but I don't think I'd change it just based on who got relegated.
Off the field, though, they have made a significant impact, built a business that's sustainable, that second largest commercial club.
That's right.
Would that be jeopardised if
Phil, surely the rewards have got to be what you do on the field, surely, hasn't it?
I don't know. There might be other spin-offs as regards expanding the sport into new markets, which I would imagine is a key driver of yours.
Yeah, well, it is, but that doesn't mean to say that people should have a kind of carte blanche to stay in the competition in respect of performances. After licensing, the game as a whole, yeah, the number of kind of emails and letters about licensing is unfair, it's locking in mediocrity, there needs to be a reintroduction, and a hope and aspiration for clubs outside of the Super League from time to time. I think the game...
But you could still have that under licensing. It wasn't a closed shop to allowing somebody to come in and saying to somebody else, your facilities aren't good enough, or...
What we found is the point Scottish just made, that people generally understand what happens on the field. They don't understand discussions in smoke-filled committee rooms and KPMG reports and somebody going around and measuring the number of seats or whatever. What they know is if you win that number of games, you go up, and if you lose that number of games, you come down. And anything that goes beyond that, there is a place for it, I'll agree with it, but anything that goes beyond that is a contaminant of that basic sporting ethic, really.
So what happens then if Catalans go down? We've got Toronto in the Championship, London potentially still in there, you've got Toulouse and Catalans. Some of those clubs, you spoke at the start of the year about the importance of Bradford Bulls in that division and the fan base they would bring. You're losing Bradford, you've lost Hull KR. It's going to be a tough sell, isn't it, for those clubs in that division?
Yeah, they haven't lost Hull KR, by the way. They've got promoted.
Well, you've lost them out of the Championship.
But the essence of this really is that, you know, clubs that aspire to be the best they can and successful professional clubs need to build home supporters. You can't build a business on the benevolence of away supporters coming up time after time after time. And you know, we will work with any and all of the Championship clubs to roll the sleeves. So what can we do to help you get more home support? You can't just rely on the windfall of Bradford Bulls turning up or Hull KR coming up or any other club turning up for that matter. It's about building home support.
Mm, is there too much of a gap now between full-time operations and part-time operations? Does that need looking at?
Well,
I've just seen
kind of London lose to Warrington by 2 points, and Halifax have given everybody a decent game, and Featherstone.
But London are full-time.
Yeah, well, okay, they are, but Halifax aren't, and Featherstone aren't, and in both circumstances.
But you look at the table, and that shows.
What shows?
That they're the part-time teams in that mix. Because they can't sustain it over 7 weeks.
What you can't do is deny them the opportunity to play, can you?
But do you say to them, you can be part of the full-time party when you go full-time, and you look to move part of the game in a direction that will be for the benefit of all and expand it to new markets?
And one of the reasons why the financial modelling is as it is to give the top four clubs in that competition the chance to be full-time. So to be very clear, in year one of this model, there were 16 full-time clubs. You know, London and Bradford were full-time clubs. Halifax went full-time, and I think, and I'm not sure, London,
Sheffield
went full-time. That's right, Sheffield, thank you, went full-time. So they were, and I don't think some of those, so it didn't do Sheffield any good being full-time or Bradford being any good full-time. So on-field performances, sometimes you can overstate and simplify, well, they're full-time and they're not. It's clearly a factor. If you've got access to the players on a more frequent basis, you should theoretically be better, but it's not guaranteed. Bradford have had the biggest wage bill probably in the outside of Hull KR this year, and for a long period of time, that hasn't been a reflection in the results, has it? So it doesn't necessarily follow.
Does the central grant, though, become a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, that the teams at the bottom still get the least, the teams at the top get the most, therefore the following year the teams at the bottom will be the same teams, the teams at the top will be the same teams?
Well, in year one of this structure, the top four, and I'm you test it, I didn't realise this was going to be a mental agility test, but in year one of this competition, the top four were included Sheffield, it was Lee, Bradford, Sheffield and Halifax, and in year two of them, Bradford, Halifax and Sheffield did not get back in, did they, in the top four? So that would not suggest that it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
But what chance of, say, a Dewsbury or a Swinton of breaking into that top four if they're only given £150,000 against a club that might have £750,000.
Well, Phillison broke into that. They weren't in their original four, and then they broke into that. And, you know, whoever else has broken it. If three of them were not in it, then another three clubs replaced them in it.
But is there, is there a glass ceiling being put in, do you think?
Look, there is always the suggestion that the more resource a club has, the better those results should be, but it's not a self-fulfilling prophecy. And the churn that took place in the clubs between years one and year two, so that's 15 to 16, would evidence that it doesn't just roll forward time after time after time.
OK, good stuff. We'll move on. We've got lots to talk about. Lots of people getting in touch tonight at RL on RY on Twitter. You can get in touch via the Radio Yorkshire Facebook page as well. You can listen online. If from time to time, the Facebook, that many people on it, might just start buffering. You can listen at radioyorkshire.co.uk as well. There's plenty of room for you to listen there. So just to clarify, Nigel, if Catalan, they get relegated, that's them. They're going out. There's no changing of the goalposts.
No changing the goalposts, and we're not playing with 13, we're just playing with 12. And, you know, I think they'll be all right on East Hull if anything stopped them going through, so that's the way it works.
Yeah, I'd let you go tell them. Well, either that, just send Scully. They don't like him in Hull anyway.
East Hull, they do. They don't mind when the red and whites. They prefer me better than the black and whites, and I play for the black and whites.
That's what you think.
That's why.
Right, Rich, you've got the unenviable task tonight of siphoning through the hundreds of messages that are coming in. So let's try and pick a few of them out then. Go on then.
Well, on many various topics, people have been asking about referees. Might as well get this one out of the way early doors because everyone's upset.
Well, let's start with the incident on Friday night. Scully, should Liam Watts have been sent off?
In today's game, era where it is, and player protection, and I guess from that, the way McAloran went in, you could see the elbow from up there. In today's game, I would have to say yes, but obviously...
Do you think he should have got sent off?
I think, yeah, in today's game, you know, with player protection, literally it was, you know, attack to the head. So, unfortunately, he had to go. Yeah.
Phil, what are you doing Thursday? I might need a new summariser. We need to take Scott to the KCOM for our live commentary on Thursday night. You might not be getting out alive. Phil, what did you make of it?
I was at another game, so I didn't see it live. I was relying on the footage that came through on social media. What I thought was interesting was that virtually every professional player who commented on it on social media seemed to think it was the wrong decision. That they thought that there wasn't a raised arm, that the tackle technique of Michael McAloran was as much to blame for his injury as the run of Liam Watts. I think the disciplinary deciding that it's sending off sufficient would tell you that there is an element of doubt, that there was some degree of predisposition to him running with his arm up. I'm not sure. I think the interesting thing would be to find out, in that situation, who makes the call. Is it the referee on the ground? Is it the fourth official? How many replays would the fourth official have? Should he intervene? Is it in his protocol and remit to intervene? Could Hull still have won with 12 men? Well, there's plenty of incidences that teams that have gone down have rallied, and they very nearly did, to be fair to them. I know that there were one or two Hull fans on social media that were vociferous that it's cost them the game and possibly a place in the top four. I think we want referees to make decisions. When it's a televised game, we need to know, do they get supplementary information to make the right decision?
We've got examples of that in the last couple of weeks, so we'll talk about that in a minute. But you're saying he should have gone. What do you say?
I'm not sure. I think a yellow card would have been more appropriate.
Right, OK.
But then I'm basing that as well on the benefit of what the disciplinary have now said.
Yeah, Rich, hindsight's a wonderful thing. Richard, well, you were watching
I thought they should have got sent off earlier for the cannonball tackle.
All right, we'll come on to that in a minute.
In the one view Rob Hicks has, not a still image on social media... Mm. And everyone needs to stop doing these still images of social media that prove one thing one way and one thing another. It probably was a red card.
Right.
He was sent off. Hull lost. Celebrate.
Nigel, what do you make of it? The incident, do you think?
Yeah, look, I can see why that decision was taken. It wasn't, as Scully said, it was contact to the head. Even though it was... The problem is we can all remember a lot worse than that, can't we? We can remember people leading with the elbow and cleaning people out. But that, and I get the point that it might not have been intentional or malicious, but nevertheless, there's a duty of care. The defending player was knocked out, and I understand why the match review panel said sending off sufficient. They haven't said not guilty, they said sending off sufficient. So, you know, I'm at peace with the whole process, really.
We make a purpose full effort on this show not to just come on and criticise refs. We feel it don't bring anything. They met Scott Gricks made a mistake last week. If Robert Hicks is deemed to make a mistake, well, that's life. We move on. But people want to know, and Phil's just mentioned it there, the video referee's getting more and more involved now. Is this a directive from you guys, or is this the video referee is just outgrowing itself?
It's the other way around, really, and it's nothing about the video referee. I think what we need to understand is we direct match officials to find reasons to say a play on if they can. What we're trying to do is we're saying, look, we're in the entertainment industry. If there's a reason why... We went through a phase probably a couple of years ago where every obstruction was blown up, even though it was 50 metres away from the try line, and everybody's scratching their head with incredulity, thinking, what is that? And there are other examples where the ball's being dropped, everyone can see it's gone backwards, and yet there's a presumption that if the ball's at the deck, we've got to give a knock-on, which in this day and age, without contested scrums, means that effectively you're giving over possession. So we've engineered a sport that puts more and more scrutiny on the refereeing. And we take the refereeing philosophy to council every year, which is a supreme membership organisation, say, we are going to ask the referees to find reasons to say play on. And is everybody at peace with that? Everybody says they're at peace with that, because we are... absolutely in the entertainment industry. Now the consequence of doing that is that sometimes they'll say play on and sometimes they won't, if you know what I mean. There's a different attitude, which is strict principle, you know, black, white, in, out, high, low, whatever it is, and you won't have a game to watch, and we would rather it be the other. The consequence is that you will have sometimes inconsistency, and that's what gets people annoyed and angry.
It does, but when the first video referee came in, it was to determine try or no try. Now we're getting 40-20 kicks. As it flicks, someone stood on the way through. We look at it for 2 minutes, and we go with the same decision.
Can you tell me how to restart the game?
How do we restart the game? Now, we were there at Leeds the other week when Gareth Ellis got Simbin on the call of the video referee. Dean Hadley got Simbin the other night I don't even know what he was supposed to have done. And then we see the Watts one. It just seems it's creeping in more and more. And people, I think they're happy. If the ref makes a call and he gets it wrong, that is what sport... That's been sport forever, hasn't it? That's why we have a ref, because the two players are never going to agree.
Absolutely.
So someone's got to have the guts to make a decision. Yeah. But it seems his power's been taken away by the video referee.
No, he hasn't been taken away. It's still his decision. So the sending off is the match official's decision. He can seek assistance if he's been blindsided. And if the truth is it gets for better justice, then I'm at peace with that. What I wouldn't want to see is every decision being forensically approved or disapproved by the video referee. And we haven't got to that situation.
But there is a lot of inconsistency, though, isn't there?
This is what I'm going to say now, because since... I say, certainly with the video referees coming on, there seems to be an onus that referees seem to want to take, rather than take responsibility themselves for making the decision from there. And so I'd like to ask from a point of view with the referees, since they've been full-time, has the standard dropped? Or have they got, because they certainly don't seem to be, as Mar just mentioned, they're consistent. And we literally say, we're not going to bag referees because they've got a job to do. But even now, when you look in the league, especially everybody's saying the standard's getting worse and worse and worse. And is the standard getting worse as it's been full time now?
No, it's not. It's not. No. I think I've tried to just contextualise that. The reality is we're asking referees to find to apply some judgment. There's a lot more scrutiny than there's ever been. There's more attention to it. I see Todd's done something significant on this on the other side of the world. You know, I think the game has got an unhealthy obsession. If you look at, and I mean at all levels, I'm talking about administration levels, media levels. The first question in the post match interview is, you must be disappointed with our refereeing display, and it's inviting coaches. I know one coach who unequivocally said if they've lost a match, his first job is to persuade his chairman that it's all been down to a bad referee, you know, because he stays in the job longer for another. And once you've got that kind of inbuilt pressure on the decision making and a rule book that is requiring them to show discretion and judgment, you end up with it becomes a bigger and bigger issue than it should do. I think we need to defuse the situation. I mean, Sean Wayne tried to trap Sean Wayne after the cup final about whether it was a try or no try, and he handled it graciously and magnanimously, which is what you would expect. You know, and he just said whether it was or whether it wasn't, it wasn't given as a try, and we haven't lost it a day because of that. We've been beaten by a better side, and there needs to be a little bit of that. You know, Scully's played the game, I played. We all know that at the end of the day, you tend to get you tend to get what you deserve.
We look at the NRL, two refs in the NRL, they get it right all the time. We had the State of Origin that came out, and basically some outlets were accusing the referees of cheating to make sure it went to a deciding game. And then Todd Greenberg has come out today and says there's got to be a culture, has got to stop of blaming the referee when you get beat. But that is coming in, isn't it? The first thing the fans blame is the referee.
And I think we've all got a role to play in that. When we're looking at why there's a shortage of referees and people are being abused and all kinds of names, you know, these are professionals. Yeah. Everywhere I go in life, whenever I interact with somebody in an office or somebody at a ticket office or whatever, there's a sign up saying our staff deserve to be treated with respect in foul and abusive life. And we think that rugby league match officials are exempt from that. Well, they're not. And whether it's a community game, a junior community game or the championship game, there is an unhealthy obsession. The referees don't get everything right. Just like players don't get everything right, they make mistakes. But I think part of the problem where we are letting our referees down, I feel I'm letting the referees down and the executives, because we're not actually explaining precisely what we're asking them to do. We're asking them to say, if you can find a reason to say, plan. I'll give you another, for instance. When you listen to the telecast, you will hear, because you hear the ref piped in, surrender and dominant. Now, what that means is that that's a kind of a private code between the players and the referee that the defending side can lay on a bit longer because they have won the ruck. Okay, so that's a management issue of the game. Now, if you've got 18,000 people in a stadium, they don't hear any of that. So all they see is one tackle, somebody's being left to lie on a bit longer, and another one is being pinged and he's got up pretty quickly because the refs actually communicated that the defending side has won the tackle or that the offensive side has given himself up to the tackle and therefore forfeit the right actually to get up quickly.
You mentioned added scrutiny, which is probably part of modern day life. Does it help that our principal broadcaster has somebody in their commentary team whose sole job it is to talk about what the referee's doing?
Well, his sole job is to clarify, you know, for people who may not know what the rules are. And look, I'm not going to come on a media show and disrespect it, you know, people that are very important to us. But I think the important thing is we need to look at ourselves to say, have we got the cleanest set of rules that we possibly can?
Well, that goes to something that Brian McDermott said the other week that was talking about the play the ball. Is that an area that, as a game, you would sit down at the end of the season and say it's got to the point where people are trying to milk penalties if they've got the ball, or a dummy halves are trying to speed up the play the ball and influence the referee? That, do we need to get that out of the game?
You're a historian of the sport, so you know how this sport has evolved over time. There was a time when the scrummage was a contested scrum, so that effectively, when you had a stoppage in play for a knock-on or a forward pass, it went to scrum and you had a 50-50, or theoretically, a 50-50 chance to get the ball back. Because that's not a contested scrum now, so a skill deficiency, like a drop ball, means effectively you're handing over possession or a play of the ball that's not particularly robust, a bit squidgy, and you end up giving possession away. And that's what I mean by we're making the referee's role in interpreting these disproportionate to the sporting contest, and we have to find a way to dial that back a little bit.
Can I just ask you to tuck in a bit, Nigel? Sorry, it's that microphone just went a bit quiet then for a moment.
Normally something you've accused.
I think I might have unplugged it.
We try that with Scotty every week. It doesn't work, sadly. What are the sport doing? Can we get? Are you going to go two referees? A lot of people clamouring for that. Can we do it, or don't you want to do it?
I don't want to do it. That's a personal view. Because I think the more referees you have, the more interventions you're going to have, the more offences you're going to find, and you'll have 50, 60 stoppages a game. And I think that's contradictory to what we're trying to do, which is provide an entertainment spectacle.
Okay.
And by the way, every conversation I have with Australian officials, they're not unanimous about two referees. They may publicly say that they want two referees and they're delighted with it, but I know full well that actually they feel like they've gone too far to back themselves out of it.
Okay, good stuff. Social media, what's happening, Rich?
Well, yeah, I'm pleased to say everyone's still banging on about Liam Watts, which means they've completely missed the point of, having an important person in the studio, so well done to the listeners for that. But I feel the need to say these things because we can talk till we're blue in the face. Liam Watts got sent off. We can't change that. No one can change that unless we invent time travel, which I don't think is under Nigel's remit. We've been asked about many and various things, including TV coverage of the championship. Obviously, with Toronto being promoted and all their games last season on Premier Sport, people watching on Free Sport as well now. People wanting to know why isn't there more coverage of, why aren't there live games of the championship in the current contract?
Can you answer that? Why do we not have more Championship action on the telly?
Yeah, the Sky owned the rights to Super League and Championship, and they choose which games they want to broadcast. And of course, with every broadcast, you'll know that there's probably a bill of about £70,000 in terms of outside broadcast costs. They do cover Championship. They cover Championship with the Summer Bash. They look at every team once, and there's at least one of the playoff games that get on there. Would we like to see more? Yes, of course we would, but we can't dictate. When you've sold your broadcast rights to you have to respect their picks. There was an exemption for Toronto because they were in League One and therefore not covered by the top two. The existing contract with Sky, so that's why that was on last year, and that will roll forward this year. Sky have allowed effectively Premier to continue coverage, but they are Sky's rights to exploit or otherwise, and the sport has taken the money in exchange for that.
Would it be in Sky's interest to allow a highlights programme of Championship games to be made during the regular season, so that when suddenly teams like Featherstone and Halifax appear on Sky, there is a bit of a backstory and a context?
It might be. Sky are wonderful, wonderful partners, and without their support for the sport and their broadcast, they would look a lot different from what it is. They're not here to deny the sport any chance that it wants to develop and to promote itself. So, if that was the right way forward, it'd be the right way forward. I'm sure that there's no reason why they would materially stop that.
How do you see the sports broadcast arena changing when this current deal ends? Because to all intents and purposes, the research that's being done is we're going to consume it in a very different way to how we are at the moment. Would you be talking to Amazon Prime, who've done a big deal with the NFL, or would you be talking to other digital providers? Would you be setting up, like the NRL have, your own huge digital division to control your content?
And with respect, that's the most important question that's been asked this evening so far. The reality is habits are changing. I've got a 17-year-old son, and I can't remember the last time he sat down and watched an 80-minute contest with me. He's a football supporter anyway, and he doesn't even do that. He consumes his sport on a handheld, on a goal alert, or whatever else. And now that has profound implications. Everybody in this room is of a certain age, and we all presumably subscribe to subscription television to watch the content, and we will do because we all know what great value it is and we all want to do that. But as people change, and as younger people, the millennials in particular, view in a different way, and I think there will be some changes going forward, and it's our job to stay in front of that discussion.
Okay, there are demons at work on that microphone. Scotty, you haven't heard from you, which is fantastic, but I think we might need to change that lead, so we might need a bit of a swap round in the studio. I think it's the lead that's more the problem. The boys are going to come and fetch that now. It's actually eased up a little bit, so it must be you, Scully. You're impacting it. You're quiet tonight, pal. You've been told to behave.
Nigel's speaking. He's asking the questions already that's being asked, but there'll be a couple of questions from the legends soon. Don't worry about that.
Yeah, he wants to know, Nigel, and he's bangs on about this every week. When you bring back Great Britain,
yes,
can the legend be the tour manager? He's asked the question. I'm asking for him now because I'm sick of hearing
it. And can he have a free shirt?
Yeah.
Well, listen, I bow to no one in my admiration for Gary Schofield. I remember when I played against him all those years ago, I knew he was destined for greatness. And I think it's important that a man of his quality...
I thought you were a lot younger than
and
him.
Experience. No. There's only a year between us, maybe 2 years between us. And I don't really know, because I only saw his boots from behind, because he just skipped round everybody and scored a load of tries. But I think the important point, without kind of sparing anybody's blushes, is that the game does need to look after people that have played and played at the highest level. And we have tried to do that over the last 10 years in all sorts of ways.
Mm. Okay, good stuff. Rich, lots of people getting in stuff. Yeah. What have you upset now?
I've upset people now. We can talk about Liam Watts all night, but he's not going to change anything. Tough. Got important things to talk about.
Okay.
Personally. Including, since we were talking about many various things, Tony Smith.
Yes.
His departure from the Warrington Wolves yesterday, which apparently wasn't a big enough news story for one of our broadcast partners to have on their website yesterday, less important than sailing or whatever, but it means he's in the market, and I'm sure plenty of clubs would be interested. I'm sure some Leeds fans are thinking, the anti-McDermott brigade would be saying, why didn't we get rid of our coach last year? We could have, But Tony Smith on the market, and of course Warrington in the... market for a new coach as well.
Looks like they're going to go Australian, Phil. Some things just do run their course, don't they? And is Tony Smith, is it a good time now to say, right, let's move on, pastures new?
I think Simon Moran thinks that, and ultimately he's the man that makes the decision. He's the man that puts the money into the club. I just think probably the people behind the scenes at Warrington will be a little bit disappointed with the way they've played in the qualifiers. They've won all five games. They're back in Super League. That was the objective. It's not necessarily about performance, but in all of them, they've not looked convincing. I go back to the game against London the other week. You know, they were very lucky to hold on to that. Lee looked like they'd taken them right to the wire and perhaps were going to win that game, and Warrington just found a way to win it in the last minute. I don't think they've been convincing in retaining their Super League status, and that will have worried the people behind the scenes at the HJ. I think they will go Australian. I think there are a couple of obvious candidates, and I don't think one of them is Michael Maguire. I think he is destined for the Gold Coast. I also think that the style of rugby he's tended to employ is not the way Warrington would look to play.
And reports he's on £400,000 a season might have something to do with that.
That may well, although with Simon Moran that necessarily wouldn't be so much of an influence. I think the two major names to look out for, one is Garth Brennan, who people may not have heard a lot about, but is being touted through the Australian game as the next great coach. He's working at the moment with the juniors at Penrith, who are doing fantastic things both in the first team and coming up and feeding that first team. His talent is such that he's just been taken on by the Kiwis for the World Cup as part of their squad, so I think look out for him. He could be a name that we haven't heard of, but could be making a bow over here. The other one is Neil Henry, who's been relieved of his duties at the Gold Coast. Most people think that he was very unfortunate that it was a personality clash with Jared Hayne, and when it came down to it, the management sided with the player, not the coach. So I think those are the kind of people that will be on Warrington's list. But Tony Smith won't be going away, I don't think.
No. Scully, any surprise for you that Warrington have parted ways with Tony?
No, not really. I'd say he's been there, what, 89 years, hasn't he? And players, you know, it's... I know myself, you know, you may get fed up with the same face and same voice from there, so maybe the motivation's gone there from the players, but it seems to be, again, you know, the players have got rid of a coach by their performances. Let's go back to the start of the season when Warrington, with that magnificent performance against Brisbane, and everybody was saying, yeah, this is Warrington's season. You know, they've got everything sorted out, but it's just been an absolute nightmare for them. And the players themselves, they've got to take responsibility for the way they played. You look at the qualifiers, what they're in now, they don't want to be there. They're sulking, but unfortunately, the players, the way they've played week in and week out, have got them in that position. And unfortunately, it's cost Tony Smith his job. There's three coaches gone this year now, in Fraser-New, in Cunningham, and now Tony Smith has gone from Warrington because, quite simply, the players haven't wanted to play for the coach and they've got the sack. But Tony Smith, he won't be out of the game too long. We all know his record. We all know the response, what he gets from players. I love the way that he wants to play the game, plays the game in the right way. So Tony's done a great job at Warrington, and as I say, he won't be long out of the game. There's no two ways about it.
A lot of talk, obviously, they are going Australian, and I believe the chief exec is going to Australia
Phil's
candidates.
Mentioned the guy's name, Braden, who I've never heard of. Well, I'll tell you what, a guy called Parrish, who went to Salford a few years ago, he wouldn't have heard of when he came
not
over here.
Not sure they did quite the due diligence.
Hold on, Phil. But what the point I'm saying is here, you know, unnamed Australians... Why do we have to... Why, oh, it's
well, what
choice.
About a named one, then? And he's doing a good job down in the Championship. Andrew Henderson, why is he not going to get a go?
Why not? I'll buy into that. I'll tell you what, the way, you know, and they say Lee Breeze, he knows the club in and out. Lee Breeze is his assistant from there. Learn off Henderson. Contact for Henderson for 3 or 4 years from there. Henderson likes to play the right way. Warrington, an entertaining club. I'd buy into Andrew Atterdale, taking the Warrington job, and Lee Breeze is his assistant, without a doubt. Mm. Yeah, I would.
Okay.
You know Tony well from his time at England. He's the kind of guy that, certainly in the short term, can get really good results out of teams.
Oh, I think his track record speaks for himself. So, I think it's an interesting decision for Warrington.
Interesting. This Liam Watts thing is really dividing. Look, I think the fact that Gary said one thing, Phil said another, Rich said another, and Nigel said he can see why he's been sent off.
Rob Hicks sent him off, that's it.
Yeah, he's sent him off.
Correct.
Get over it. He's gone. Yeah, it might have hurt.
He's not got a ban.
But he's not being banned
next week.
So he'll play against Wakefield. And apparently Wakefield have got no chance, according to Scully. They're never going to win again because of Scott Grix's mistake last weekend. That's what you said.
Yeah, listen, the point is, what I'm saying is here, right? The howler by Scott Grix, that ball should have been on the M62, should have been back on the trailer of a wagon going to Hull, OK. And quite simple here now, the experience what Hull have got, the experience what Wigan have got in big games from there, I'm telling you, Wakefield's season has finished. They will not beat Hull. They will not beat Wigan. It's as simple as that. And honestly,
I think there's some kind of forfeit coming up here. I was going to a very big one on your behalf.
You've got to believe the legend, because he's right on this one. Hey, listen, Everybody listens to this show week in and week out, and I can reassure you, I'm not often wrong.
I was going to go next Saturday, but I won't bother now.
Well, there's no point. No. You know, stay Michael, on. If you're listening, yeah. Don't bother. Don't
close
bother.
The gates.
Don't bother making the chips.
Don't let them in.
Don't need
it. They're still in their own hands, those players. They're all right. They'll have given him rounds of the kitchen. You know, he didn't do it on purpose. He'll have apologised.
Listen, hold on.
They're
hold
more
on.
Professional than that.
Hold on. Did I say he did it on purpose? No, he didn't. But one thing for sure, he could have showed a little bit more enthusiasm, a little bit more, desire just to get that ball. Quite simple. I'll tell you about 2 years. Remember when Danny Maguire put that ball, Nigel mentioned it earlier, with the helicopter was on its way to Wigan. On its way to Wigan. Can you remember, Maguire put the kick over. Mm-hmm. It was heading to the touch. It would have done. Who didn't show the right commitment and enthusiasm? It was Scott Griggs. What did Ryan Hall do? He collected the ball. Nigel Wood, hey, helicopter, get your centre round. Get your centre round, because Ryan Hall going over for the four-pointer. It was the same player. Just not showing that in thinking the bounce of the ball, of a rugby league ball, as we know, it's embarrassed many, many people.
This is the same player who will be in a lot of people's dream team selections, who was one of the major reasons why Wakefield are even challenging
Phil,
in the top
and four. I've said it to Mark Wilson, I'll say it to you again, you're only as good as your last game.
Why were Wakefield playing on their own line in the last minute of a game that they dominated for 77 minutes?
Listen, mate.
Because their game management wasn't good enough.
Listen, I agree.
And that was nothing to do with Scott Brooks.
Phil, I agree. They locked up, the close-up shop, they went boring, they went kicking. They went, we'll kick it into touch, we'll play ball in rugby league. They got found out.
But for the lack
of a bit of enthusiasm. I tell you what, Johnny Lomax showed some enthusiasm to get the four-pointer, didn't he? Listen, we've got a Wakefield fan there. What did you think he said before?
I don't think it was lack of enthusiasm when you lift your leg up and the ball goes underneath it.
No.
Listen. You're all getting into the mode where, oh, no, I don't feel like as though we should criticise players.
If Liam Finn had missed the kick properly and it had gone dead, it wouldn't have even happened.
Listen, I've told you before and I'm going to repeat myself again. I know what criticism's all about. The only time Great Britain ever got beat by Papua New Guinea, they'll never get beat by Papua New Guinea again. But it was all my fault and I took it because I blamed myself, and so did the press, and so did Malcolm Reilly, and so did the players. Did I cry? Did I say, oh, don't
okay,
go inside
okay.
me?
Scott,
I ain't going to be the
we'll
player
go,
again.
We'll go back
Lord
to that, We'll go
Absolute
back to that.
Lord of touch.
We'll go back to that, Garrett. What happened the week after?
Yeah, I learnt my lesson. Mal Reilly said, hey, listen, do you know how to play standoff? So I said, yeah. He said, right, you're the main man. What happened then? 48-10, bang, bang, bang.
Right. So why can't Wakefield do that?
Well, I hope they do. I hope they do, surely.
You said they're going to lose.
Oh, yeah, because Hull and Wigan, do you know why? Because Hull and Wigan are under the pressure a lot better. There's my reason.
Them Witness fans are right about you, anyway. At RL on our wife, you're going to get in touch on Twitter. Lots of people getting in touch on Facebook, so a lot of things we need to have a look at. Johnny Lomax's name came up there, Nigel. He has got one of these new contract payments. How did he get picked? And when are we going to get some more names picked?
Yeah, we're not doing anything until 2018, but we'd done something with Callum Watkins, and I think the important thing is that we recognise as a governing body that the retention of talent can't just fall on the clubs. The clubs can't just be the total kind of bear the total cost of retaining players when we're losing players to the. And we've got some commercial partners that want to look at improving the profile of England and working with a set number of, if you like, the faces of England. So on the selection of any player who's under consideration for central ambassadorial contracts, it's, if you like, a three-way test. The performance department have to have a view, because clearly you need players that are going to represent England, and it isn't just whether they're going to represent them, it's whether or not you've also got the kind that you can rely on them effectively. There's going to be nothing in the private life that is going to embarrass you going forward, and then the marketing team and the commercial team need to confirm that they are of value to commercial sponsors. So that's how it will evolve, but the underlying motivation behind it is to keep British talent in the British game, and because we felt kind of in our kind of hearts that the centre wasn't doing enough and doing its fair share of the lifting.
How many? I was going to say, how many is your aspirational number to have on those contracts?
Look, when we originally kind of conceived it, we thought it'd be about 10 or a dozen, something like that. Might be less than that, might be more than that. We're not just, these won't be just handed out, you know, by confetti. We had to negotiate this through and make sure that it didn't imbalance the league as well. You couldn't have them all from one club and those kind of things. So it will be, the market will tell us when people say, well, this person is of value, this is the kind of person we can use, because he represents the ideals and the values that we're looking for, and the coaching staff are convinced that they've got a 5-year international career in front of them.
It almost seemed to me a good news story, but it came out by accident. The club divulged what was happening. To me, this is something that they big up the draft in the NFL. It's all over the telly. I'd like you to come out at the start of the year and say, right, these are the 10. Yeah. These are the 10 that are getting the money, and these are the 10 that are going to help England win the World Cup or whatever.
Yeah, well, we didn't announce it. That was it. Well, you're right to point that out. And it is something that we need to learn from, because it has been a bit of a stalled process. So we need to get that bit right. And some of that is just because we needed to formulate the precise criteria for it. And we will do better on that in 18.
Is it the kind of thing that you can get new commercial partners on the back of, that they can look at the personalities we've got in the sport who have always been our greatest asset, but it would be fair to say we perhaps haven't used enough? And that we can generate some new commercial revenue on the back of that scheme?
That's certainly the intention, Phil. The idea is that our international players and our national profile deserve the boost that creating stars. We don't want to just, you know, I know we've got a number of players that are playing in the NRL, but we've got a great domestic competition and there are stars all over it, and I think the centre needed to be seen to do more to actually promote both those players and raise revenues, and it does provide a commercial opportunity for our partners. As part of the England programme and the Great Britain programme over the course of the next 5 years is wonderful. We've got a World Cup in, 6 weeks' time or there and thereabouts. We've got the Kiwis here in 18, a Lions tour I look forward to in 19, that took some winning through, the Kangaroo tour in 20, and then a World Cup in 21. So we've got, I think, a golden opportunity to elevate the profile for the sport and the profile for the players of the sport. It's not right that most people, when they look at, you know, who they recognise walking down Oxford Street, it would be Martin Afire or Ellery or Gary or Sean Edwards or Andy Farrell, people that have gone on subsequently and played a bit of rugby union and had a profile. You know, we need to make sure that our current clutch of players are given that respect.
Well, could the money be earmarked for bringing players back from rugby union, or is it only players who are currently playing in Super League?
No, I think once we start, this isn't a kind of a program to acquire players effectively. If the right player would add value to our sport and our commercial sponsors thought that was that person would represent an added value to the sport, you know, we'd look at that. But it's not one really for repatriation.
You talk about players becoming household names or being recognised faces. If you don't have Sky, you don't really see a lot of rugby league on the TV. We have the Super League show on in the middle of the night in the north. Any plans to get more TV exposure? Because we look, you know, I said last night I was working elsewhere on the TV. The Aviva Premiership and now our highlights package look fantastic. We need something like that. Why do we not have that?
Well, because at the end of the day, the market will tell you what they're prepared to pay for. You know, the channel. We talk when we do our broadcast contracts. We talk to everybody and ask everybody what they'd like to do. We don't just go back to Sky and go back to the BBC and say, "Shall we go around again on the same terms?" We market test it all, and I think we do have a good terrestrial output. You say that it's mainly Sky. Well, it is mainly Sky, but I wouldn't have it any other way. They pay the money.
So
you know, if someone said to me, "You're going to get 3 games a weekend on," you know, I think people forget what it used to be like when you just had the John Player Trophy on in October, November,
second
and
half.
December. Yeah. Oh, second half BBC Two. And then after the Christmas, you'd then have a Challenge Cup. You know, I think at its peak, Rugby League probably had, 18 episodes effectively on BBC Grandstand or there in any one season. John Player followed by Challenge Cup, and then if there was a Kangaroo Tour, that. And then, let alone getting pictures flown in from overseas tours. I know we've been spoiled since then, and we've got a blend here of week in, week out regular content that I think is excellent. And then we've got the Challenge Cup competition, the highlights programme on the BBC and the international programme on the BBC. So we would hope there's a nice balance between week in, week out and those high spots that deliver the mass audience.
So are you saying, Phil, are you saying then that ITV, for example, or Channel 5 are not interested in taking the Challenge Cup, because we hear that the viewing figures are very strong, and surely to a commercial station that would big pull.
I'm not saying anything on any one individual station, other than whenever the rights go out to market, we don't just go back to the same two companies.
Okay. You've trialled the service with the England Samoa game that was your own product but behind a paywall. We didn't really get any accurate feedback on how that went, although we were told at the time that we would be advising it. How did it go? Can you let us know if it was a success or not?
Who told you at the time? I don't know.
I think at the time, was it Roger said, we'll let you know whether it was successful or not? Or what would count as success?
I think the important thing about this Samoa game is that, and I know we were roundly criticised, and I do get that, and I understand that, but we about half an hour ago we talked about preparing for the next broadcast contract and how that actually all these other issues we're talking about, whether it's the structure of the season or the standard of refereeing or Liam Watts or whatever it may be, or whether or not Scott Griggs should be, you know, in the stocks in Wakefield, you know, whatever that may be. But the real big question for the sport is, how do we prepare and organise ourselves for a changing broadcast world that will take place in 2021? That's the big question. That's what the stewards of the sport, and I include myself in that, that's what we're paid to try and get right.
I tell you what, you just mentioned the stocks there, Nigel, as well. We're talking about England here and with the World Cup, and I think, you know, I might just mention, you've got to bring the name up now in Wayne Bennett, and do you know what, I'm absolutely delighted, as I say, an ex-Greybrand captain, that we've got a plan in place for the international calendar coming up. Obviously, Wayne, obviously the debate, and my debate is, hopefully he doesn't pick any Australians for the World Cup, because the talent what we've got there, and we have an England pathway through, and I say I don't want any sort of Australian playing for us, and for mine, at times it just seems it's Wayne's way or no way. But also as well, we're looking at a five-year plan. Is that a Wayne Bennett five-year plan, or after the World Cup, are we getting the coach everybody wants, hopefully, in Darryl Powell and play the right way?
Wayne's contract is to the end of this World Cup, and we won't sit down and have any conversations with either him or anybody else till after that. I mean, you made a lot of points there. There is a plan towards 2021. Kevin's Sinfield's, the reason we put players of repute in the performance department is to increase the confidence that there are people that actually know what they're talking about in helping England and Great Britain plan. We're hoping to do something with the equipment of England Knights next year, a restoration of the emerging England squad, you know, with games potentially against France and in the Europeans. We're just working through that as we speak. The RFL is acutely aware that we represent the national interests, and we want to do everything we can. I'm not going to sit here and say who's going to be the coach in January 2018, because that would be utterly inappropriate, but we are aware of that. And look, whilst your nationalism is to be commended, and I understand that, you know, Wayne Bennett is the most decorated coach in world rugby, and as you will know, because you speak to the players, every single one of the players that get picked that come back with a positive experience about it. You know, this is not an unhappy camp.
Gary didn't. He went round to Wayne's and wouldn't let him have 17 pints.
Yeah.
What made you choose Wayne Bennett? I mean, you just said he's the most decorated coach. He's obviously, his CV is monumental. Yeah. But is that why you went, to bring the World Cup? Or
that reminds me of that Mrs. Merton question. What first attracted you to the millionaire Paul Daniels?
Well,
his record is second to none. He's succeeded at international level, origin level, at club level. He expressed a significant interest in it. It wasn't just a panic. I think the issue for the RFL was we'd had a good and a great coach in Steve Mack. I mean, let's be very clear about it. Steve Mack took on a national team that was not at a high spot, really. We'd had a disappointing 2008 World Cup. I think even, you know, everybody's most loyal supporters would say that wasn't good enough. And although we'd emerged out into 2009, we'd had a disappointed period. And Steve substantially reconstructed the programmes and the mood around the national team, the two team approach. You play for your team, you play for your national team, and made some significant progress. There were a lot of people thought he shouldn't have been retained after the World Cup in 2013, but he got to coach the team in a home World Cup, and we were significantly loyal to him by giving him another 2-year contract beyond that. And therefore, at the end of 6 years, Steve wasn't sacked. He had a six-year contract as the national coach, and he had received the support and achieved an awful lot. The question the RFL had is, would our chances of winning the World Cup in 2017 be enhanced by a change of coach 2 years out, or the retention of the same coach we'd had for 6 years for a further 2 years? So that was what went through people's minds.
What would be success then for Wayne Bennett in this World Cup?
Well, Wayne, as always, I'm not going to speak for Wayne Bennett. He's perfectly good at.
Well, what is it? Well, I presume you've given him a target. What is
well,
that?
Well, of course, you know, we don't enter competitions without wanting to win them. You know, it's glib to say that, but why wouldn't we say that? You know, we've got a group of players that are perfectly capable of doing the business out there. Wayne's position always that as long as the lads play to their potential and the best they can, then you can't ask any more than that. But you know, I think we're in with a really good shout.
You mentioned the five-year plan. I know it's only one result, and I know it's at a level below the senior team, but are you worried that the England under-16s have just lost to Wales under-16s? Are we reading too much into the fact that the England players were already attached to Super League academies, the Wales guys, a lot of whom were actually 15, are only coming out of two part-time clubs and some community, don't have any funding? Is that something that we should be... thrown at the performance department.
We're
going
to have to be quick because we've
got
the news. So you've got 30 seconds, Nigel.
I'll postpone the news.
Look, would we rather have won? Of course we'd rather have won. But the other interesting thing is this. One of the challenges facing the sport in Europe is finding good opposition and making sure we've got good opposition. The reason Australia and the reason New Zealand has emerged is because they get to play Australia every year. We need to make sure Wales and France in particular are of the right standard. Then we have meaningful competition without having to fly around the world.
Very good. Thank you for that. That is our number one. It's flown by already here on Radio Yorkshire. More to come on Twitter at RL on RY. You can get in touch.
Proper Sport at 6. If it's good, we'll tell you. If it's rubbish, we'll tell you. This is Radio Yorkshire, the only place for honest opinions on the greatest game.
Welcome back to Rugby League on Radio Yorkshire. I can tell you for, all those asking how Nigel earns his wages, he's now the Radio Yorkshire tea boy. So there you go, can't say any more than that. We'll move on. Lots of people getting in touch, and we do seriously appreciate each and every one of you getting in touch. We will probably revisit a lot of what's coming in. It is, we're inundated, and we do appreciate everyone that's taking the time to text
in. Just to praise some of the things you've missed, the Catalans will not be saved if they're relegated.
Yes, and they're going down. If they finish down, they're down.
Referees are referees. And unless, we asked Nigel Wood about what happened with Liam Watts and this and that and the other, he can't say they're going to give Hull the points and take them off Wigan. So there's no more...
The fact that we went round the room and we all had a different opinion of the same incident, having had a million more looks at it than Robert Hicks had.
He has a split second to make that decision. The player has to make that decision as well.
We also got some clarification of the fact that the people at the top of the sport recognise the need to do something more about the way the game's interpreted.
Very good. We have got plenty more to discuss here. Nigel Wood is our guest. If you just joined us tonight, you can get in touch at RL on RY. You can get in touch via the Radio Yorkshire Facebook page as well. A lot of people, it's fair to say, Nigel, they want to talk about the Bradford Bulls. So I'm going to ask you about the Bradford Bulls. I think you've already answered it in public anyway, but are they going to be playing in League One next season?
Yes. Why would they not be? The rules on promotion and relegation were published beforehand, unfortunately for them, they haven't won the required number of games, and that's their destiny.
There's a myth that they're going to be saved. You're going to keep them up. Yeah, can you? That's it. Categorically, they've gone. They're in League One.
They are relegated. What I can't do is stare into the future and predict what else may happen around there, but fundamentally, as I sit here now, they are relegated, because that's the way the system works.
Can I ask for one clarification, which I think, again, you may have answered before, and if you have, I apologise. When Bradford were put in the Championship this year, which even a fair amount of their supporters thought was the wrong place for them to be. The line that was used, and I hope I'm not misquoting, was that it was in the interest of the sport that they stayed in the Championship. But I'm not sure we were ever told exactly what those interests were.
Look, it was a very difficult situation, and these are not easy discussions and decisions. What had happened is that the previous club had sold X number of season tickets to a support base who had bought them in the expectation that they'd be playing in Championship. The whole of the league structure, that's the other 11 clubs in Championship, had built their seasons around the fact that Bradford were in there. You know, I think it was only by the time we actually resuscitated or generated a new club, there was only, I think it was 3 weeks before the first game, which was at Hull KR, and Hull KR had already done whatever they'd done in tickets. There wasn't an obvious alternative strategy. I think that on balance, it was the right decision. They won four out of the first nine games. If they'd have kept that win ratio up, they'd have won half of them. So although they had a 12-point penalty, we were very mindful of the fact that if there wasn't a club in Bradford, and there nearly wasn't, you know, that club went into liquidation, and there for a period of time was not a club, and a new club was created, because the game felt, and I felt in particular, that we'd got a debt of honour to season ticket holders who had bought a ticket in good faith, and were in danger of losing any value for that. So that was the decision making, and you could have called it a different way. There wasn't a natural alternative to putting Bradford in the Championship. You know, there wasn't anybody kind of putting the hand up saying, you know, we want to do this.
Did you ask all the clubs, Nigel?
Well, I didn't, but I wasn't handling the issue. Ralph and Karen Morehouse were handling the issue. But, I mean, the other thing is this. Clubs have... they know their destiny 3 months out, don't they? They know their destiny from October. Well, as we've just discussed, they know their destiny now from September. And they recruited players based on the competition they were going to be in. So for all of those reasons, there was an expectation that the season 2017, at both League One and Championship, being built around the fact that a club from Bradford was in that division, which is why. And the fact that you couldn't just let an act of insolvency go through without some recognition of that, which is where the 12-point deduction came through, and that was the balance that was struck. But these are very difficult decisions, and what I would say is that the board is a 7-person board. They're all independent. They're not from a club. There's no vested interest. There's nobody saying, well, we want them there or we want them there. These are all independent people that try and do the best for the widest good, and that's what that decision's about.
Is it fair to compare it to Glasgow Rangers, who 15 days out from the start of a Scottish season were relegated down to to start again as a new club?
Look, I don't know the facts about Glasgow Rangers as such, but you know, I do recognise that given the circumstances that prevailed, the fact that the club went into administration, if I got that right, either October or November. The administrator kept it in administration for a long, long time and finally ceased trading in January. And there was, until that point, there was still a hope that old club was going to be resuscitated. So thereafter, a completely new race had to be established. And by the way, there wasn't a queue of people running around the block saying, we want to take this on. So, you know...
Is that another reason why it should have started in League One, though, if there weren't a lot of people coming in? Was it always going to be under-resourced for the challenge of trying to get back this 12-point deduction? Was it a condemned man before a ball was even kicked?
Well, as I said earlier, I think the records show that they won four out of the first nine games. I don't know the marks looking at that and then, of course, another action occurred. This legal action has occurred, which has destabilised the club throughout the season, and they didn't win a game for X number. If they'd have maintained that kind of success rate or not, then they would have had 50% wins, which would have delivered 30 fixtures at 30 points and would have been enough to keep them out of trouble.
Well, people say without the points deduction, and that's what I was looking at there, Terry's just messages now and saying, well, you give them the 12 points back, they would, in effect, be fourth from bottom now. Yeah. So it's when does the punishment stop, isn't it? That's the thing. But is now, do you feel, they're going down? The worry I have as a Bradford person is they're getting £75,000 next season. And how much of that have they got to give you back, or the RFL back, in rent? They haven't got any. They've got any sense, in essence, they've got no money.
I think everybody in the sport recognises that Bradford Bulls are one of the biggest clubs, and you know, you would hope and expect that this sport would be at its biggest if they were playing in the top division. But you can't artificially move people in there one way or the other. We have got rules on insolvency. It applies to everybody. You know, nobody's exempt from that. If there is an act of insolvency, there is a points deduction. I go back, whilst you can recreate the removal of the 12 points and say that's a pivotal factor, I could also say that they've played the start of this season and won in virtually 50% of their games, which would also put them where that would be without. So these are difficult decisions. No one said these are easy decisions, and they are difficult decisions, but you know, at the end of the day, you have to have some policies.
Scully, did the Bulls get it wrong when they appointed Jeff Toovey? I mean, his championship knowledge is not great, is it? Let's be fair.
Not really. And like I say, I would imagine there'd have been some young British coaches who would have, you know, liked that opportunity there to take this great big club. I know Nigel just mentioned there that Bradford Bulls, you know, are one of the big clubs. Well, not anymore. They're not anymore. They're fighting for everything what they can get from now, aren't they? But yeah, I would have liked to have seen a British coach. And I'll tell you what, because I've spoken to, I know he's doing a great job at Barrow from there, but Paul Cleary, he would love an opportunity to get his hands on one of these big clubs. And I'll tell you what, a British coach like that, with the sort of enthusiasm and desire to get these sort of clubs where they want to get back to, you know, and I say, I'd like us just to, you know, to look at home a little bit more, and I say, give the opportunities to these lads, because every time I've seen two of it, it's a matter of, well, I'm here now and I'll see what I can do. But whoever he's got the 100%, you know, for the job and get the Bulls back where they want to get, I'm not convinced, to be honest. No,
you,
I'm not.
You mentioned that obviously the clubs who may have been in a position to take Bradford's place, let's say, for example, Whitehaven, who were the last club to be relegated, had already bought their players for League One. But would you not have given them an extra £75,000 if they'd have been in the Championship, which could have then meant that they could have supplemented their squad?
Well, players are under contract at that period of time, and that's, you know, one of the issues in evaluating what to do with a new club in Bradford is that there were a number of players. Unfortunately, when the club went into administration, a lot of their players were taken by other clubs. But there was still a caucus of players training, if you like, under their own remits on the possibility of re-employment with a new club that all happened to be based in Bradford and all theoretically were Championship players. I get why with the benefit of hindsight people think that we'd have been better put them in League One. I do understand that. It's interesting that, you know, everybody in Bradford seems to think that the RFL has got an agenda against Bradford, and virtually everywhere I go, everywhere else seems to think that we've bent over backwards to try and retain Bradford in A division. And in a bizarre sort of way, that reassures me that we're actually in the right place in the middle, because, you know, we're not. We're trying to be fair, we're trying to be faithful, and we're trying to do the right thing by the club, but respecting the integrity of the competitions.
If you had, you could go back, would you have done anything different with respect to Bradford?
I think given the circumstances, it's hard not to make the same conclusions. I think that, far be it from me, I don't know what's gone in the Bradford dressing room this year. Somebody else will have to explain why after 9 matches you've got 4 wins and then you don't win another match for 15 games. That doesn't seem to me like a normal profile of the season. And of course, since relegation was confirmed, they've gone on a 4-week match winning. So there is something in there, but that's for the owners or the coach or the players to explain for themselves. But I think that that squad of players at the start of the year were capable of winning 1 out of 2 games.
The owners there, Nigel and Graham Law, Mr.
Chalmers.
Chalmers, yeah. Are they for the long term? Full commitment for the long term?
I think so.
Surely that's what the Bulls fans want to hear, don't they?
When they made their pitch to start a new club, because that's what it was, they very much focus on the fact that this was a slow and steady build. I think people forget that they were asked to create a new club at 3 weeks' notice with the only players on the market were not the players in Whitehaven or Barrow, were players that had been training for the old Bradford club and stayed training for the old Bradford club. And I think, I'm not sure they properly understood what they'd let themselves in for. I don't think they recognised that there'd be a legal action commenced against the new owners of the club.
Is that a worry? Is that a worry for the club moving forward?
Well, I'm not here to explain the club's position, but I, you know, I dare say they preferred it wasn't there.
Mm, okay.
With the benefit of hindsight, should Toronto have started in the Championship?
Well, look, I know that's a convenient conclusion, and there's an awful lot.
No,
of
it couldn't have been done.
There's an awful lot of hindsight.
I'm not saying they should have been swapped because that couldn't have been done logistically. But should Toronto have started in the Championship?
When we took the issue of Toronto's admission into the Championship structure to the clubs, they unanimously supported it, but unanimously stated that they had to start at League One and win their rights through, because it's back to the discussion about licensing and otherwise. People understand what goes on the field effectively, and the moment you move off that into decisions taken in smoke-filled committee rooms, people get a bit suspicious of that. Who's made that decision? Why have they made that decision? Toronto were put in League One and have won their rights to play in the Championship next year, and really that's what was asked of them.
Do you think, therefore, would that change? Because there's talk of a team in New York, there's talk maybe of another Canadian team. Would they have to start? Because to be fair to League One, there's been a lot of issues. Players can't get time to go, they're part-time. Would you look at that maybe differently if we do get a New York coming in? Would they maybe go into the Championship?
There's a possibility, but fundamentally, the right now our policy would be, if there's a new admission of a club, it would join at the bottom of the professional pyramid.
Okay. Are you aware of interest? Has there been any applications for more North American teams to come in?
Yes.
And do you anticipate that we might get a new team in the near future?
I think there's a possibility. I wouldn't like to put a percentage on that. I'm not saying it's a slam dunk 90%. I think a lot of people have taken notice of the innovation that the inclusion of the Wolfpack has represented. I think it's no coincidence that two South African teams have joined the Pro 12s or the Magnus League or the Celtic League. I know that was different circumstances because they were actually demoted from their own divisions and they needed somewhere to play. I think that the world is shrinking. I think the world is shrinking and finding ways of keeping our sport at the forefront of people's attention is important, and having the first transatlantic team has been a remarkable success. We've got to do a full evaluation. I don't know what the bill's going to be for that yet, but the undertaking was that the owners would support their inclusion, so the game, if you like, is not exposed on it, but I think it's a very exciting innovation for the sport.
Is that how you, sorry, Phil. I'll ask, and then I'll promise I'll let you say. If Roman Abramovich turned up, rings you up tomorrow, says, "Nigel, I heard you on the show last. Fantastic show," he says. I want one of these rugby league teams. What would you say to him? You can have one, but you're in League One.
No, I'd tell him to buy an existing one.
Right.
The Bulls.
Yeah.
that would be in League One.
I said, buy one of the existing one. That's the
But are we actively... We've seen it in football now. It's how much money can you spend on one thing. Would you go out and cut? Do you go out and speak? I mean, do we try and attract people like that to our game?
Yes, we do. It's become infamous, the flight to Dubai where Marwan Kukash had the misfortune to have the seat next to me and vice versa, and 3 years later he's owning Salford and the rest of his time he's just making my life a misery. But
that's the Salford fans are making his life a misery at the moment, because they're not turning up, are they?
Yeah, well, 1400. No, they're not. Look, I think it's... The centre's job is to try and find people that prepare to invest in rugby league, and that we that's part of what we try and do. But you can't twist people's arm up the backs and say you must do this, because I think there has to be a deep love and affection for the sport. I think, because when the going gets tough, if you're not careful, you just leave it. So what you don't want is casual owners.
Mm. Okay.
If a team from New York was to come in, or Boston, or Montreal, or Vancouver, and they promised a television deal, but that was to the benefit of everybody, but yes, that was contingent upon the fact that they had to play against Toronto. That's where they thought the interest was in their home market. Yeah. Would that colour which division they might go in?
Well, there's a lot of hypotheticals there, isn't
there? There are. But if I was involved in one of those consortia, that's how I would want I'd say we've seen what Toronto have done. We've seen the money they've spent. We've seen the proving ground that you put them through. We've also seen the fact that it hasn't helped the division that they've been in for some of the part-time clubs that have had to play them. So if we come in and we invest as Mr. Abramovich's business partner, we'd like to play in the same division as Toronto. Is that a possibility that you would consider?
Look, there are always possibilities. There are always hypotheticals. What is true in that is that the whole point of putting expansion clubs in is to try and increase the revenues that flow back to the game here. You know, that it's not just a vanity project or an ego project. It's can we find a way to improve the revenues so that the game here is stronger as a consequence. I spent the back end of last week in France trying to get French broadcasters to increase their support for and interest in the sport of rugby league, and that's because we've got Catalan and Toulouse in, and there has to be a point to that. That's not just it makes a difference to go to Catalan as it goes to Castleford. There's got to be a business case for it.
Will that business case only work again if they're in the top division together? Are they French broadcasters interested if they're in the Championship, for example?
Well, those discussions are ongoing, and again, it wouldn't be right to be indiscreet. I'd like to be as open as I can on things, but you know, at the end of the day, it's in everybody's interest to improve the amount of French broadcast interest and financial contribution towards the cost of including French clubs in the British game.
Sean has asked the question. Is that what he wants to know about? He's getting a bit upset because he wants. He said, "We're not asking the questions you're answering."
Well, no, we are
taking the consensus. There have been hundreds, thousands of people asking questions. We try to get around everything. What do you want to know about?
We just mentioned Toulouse. We just mentioned Toronto. They're obviously in the Championship next year, along with potentially London, potentially not Catalans, potentially not. And losing Hull, Kingston Rovers and Bradford Bulls from that division. Is there any concern over the future of the Summer Bash? Because obviously in Hull KR and Bradford, two groups who brought a hell of a lot of supporters to the event this year.
I think if there was a Summer Bash without well-supported sides, it would diminish as a consequence. It's still a great weekend for Championship Rugby League. It's a great it's a great television product as well. It's the time when Championship gets its fair share of attention, but it would be a concern. Excuse me. I think we're back to the same point as before. We have to have clubs in the professional pyramid that are not dependent upon away support for their viability. That's not the way to build a club. They've got to grow home support, but we've got a commitment to deliver Bash in one form or other.
Okay, you've got a commitment to that. Yes. Where's the Magic Weekend going to be? Because Scotty wants to book his hotel room because he's refusing to share with Rich, so we're going to need more rooms. So we need to know, where is it?
I thought we'd announce that. Haven't we announced that? You've got me worried now. I thought Roger announced that.
Not yet.
All right, OK.
Come on, we've got an exclusive now. We've got an exclusive. Hey? Because I'm hoping it's Newcastle, because I'm not sharing again with Richard Shaw, right? No chance.
So when is... this is a thing that you do get... the Rugby League get criticised for, is that we... Record crowds, we all love it, we want to go, we want to book it, make a big weekend out of it. We don't know when it's going to be, it's going to be, or where it's going to be.
If we haven't announced that, we will be doing very shortly. And I think everybody is aware that it's been a great success in its current venue over the last couple of years.
I'll tell you what as well, Nigel.
Very good. Right, Scotty, you get on the website, son.
That's it, just talking about...
But it is in November.
Because I mentioned it to Nigel last year up at Newcastle, because I think he's brilliant from there. But I say we've got the World Cup over here in 2021, haven't we? I think it would be fantastic, Nigel, to get a double header there at Newcastle. Opening there Friday night under the lights, it would absolutely be rocking, and 52,000 up there. I know Newcastle have been up there, and I know, unfortunately, my great mate Lee Crooks lost his job up there from a point of view from a development side. But if we are looking at getting into new areas from there and the interest from there, I reckon that would be a seller for us. Honestly, a double header there, the World Cup kicking off, England, Australia, Scotland whoever, I think it would be rocking.
And that's we're just appointed John Dutton, who's a very good, experienced and competent administrator to be the CEO of the World Cup in 2021. We're just about to start the bidding process for matches and venues and camps. And I think everybody recognises that the sport has put a lot into the North East over the course of the last 20 years, actually, now since Shane came over and launched Gates. And there's a lot of community rugby up there. I'd be very, very surprised if the North East didn't feature in the World Cup in 21.
Okay. Gary mentioned that his good friend Lee Crooks now isn't involved in a development position. we don't seem to have the same number of development officers. Well, we haven't got the same number of development officers we had. Is that something that we should be ashamed of, or is there a logic behind that? Is there an alternative? There's a whole group of players now that are starting to retire who've been full-time professionals for the first time ever. Yeah. Is that a resource that we could use in a development role in the future, perhaps?
And some of them are, aren't they? Look, it's not... Players who finish playing have got their own... You know, I was listening to a programme yesterday with Luke Menzies going into wrestling, mm-hmm. and so, you know, players have got their own... The underlying point is that a lot of our development work was funded by Sport England. And Sport England made a structural decision, really, that they would rather not invest as much through national governing bodies, and they wanted to invest in what are called county sports partnerships and other private providers like Parkrun and other kind of private sector deliverers of sport solutions. So as a natural consequence of that, we end up losing some positions that are being funded. Now, were we treated more severely than anybody else? No, we weren't. We were given a range under which we could expect a funding, and it would peak at 11 million over 4 years, and we ended up, our bid won 10.75, so it was whatever that is, 98% of what was available to the sport. But there has to be, you know, there are consequences when you have been at 20, you're now at 11, then you clearly can't employ as many people. But I would say one thing. We have, through the Sky Tri programme, for the first time the sport, from its own resources, has invested millions of pounds in the development of the sport through the professional club foundations, millions of pounds, and we'll reach 100,000 players, young players, every year. Excuse me. Our target is 700,000 young players. Now, we've only got, what have we got? We've got 50,000 adult participants, or there and thereabouts, and more. With Masters and with Touch and with Tag and those derivatives, there are more people playing different versions of rugby league. But when you think about the Sky Tri programme ran through the professional club foundations is enormous in reaching and delivering the sport to all these young people.
Academies has been hot on the list. That Super League clubs are allowed not to run academies. Fans do not think this is right.
Yeah.
Is this going to become mandatory? Should it be mandatory?
Well, there's an incentive to run it. There's some direct funding that goes to run it, so you are incentivised to do it. The thing about academies is they've got to be run for the right reasons. There's no point just running an academy to make everybody feel good about themselves if the calibre of player available to play in those academies means that none of them are ever going to go on and make full-time professional careers. So we've got to make sure that the number of academies is a reflection on the number of 16-year-olds that are capable of going into an academy with the prospect of then being a full-time professional. Otherwise, it's a waste of resource.
You talk about how many players have we got to play the game, but how many players do we lose out of the game? Because when they reach 18 and a club's got to make a... Is that kid going to be a Super League player next year? Probably he's not. We'll get rid of him. If there's a reserve league, then maybe they might say, well, we'll give him another year and we'll see how he gets on.
Yeah.
And then in 2 years, he might be a Super League player. What reserve grid, where are we on this one?
Yeah, listen, unlike Gary, who could play the game, I couldn't really play the game, but the best years that I had playing the game was when I was playing in the reserves at places like Halifax and Huddersfield, and I wouldn't have swapped that for the world, and I love that. And there was a degree of dual registration there. When Jack Scrobe didn't want me to play, he moved me back to West Bowling to play, and they didn't want me either. So I mean, I'm not naturally a supporter of dual registration because I think you end up in environments that are not healthy for the player. But if you can make dual registration work because the relationships are very strong, say between Leeds or Huntsler, it's not my job to tell Gary or Gary Hetherington or Brian McDermott that this particular 19-year-old, his development would be better off in an alliance team, a reserve team, when he could be playing first team for, say, Featherstone or Halifax or Bradford or wherever he plays first team. So it is horses for courses. The clubs that think that reserve grades is the right model for them are at liberty to do that. We will facilitate that competition. But to ask somebody, a club, to say, yeah, by the way, it's going to cost you 50,000 or 80,000 or whatever it costs to run a competition when the best of the juniors, the Danny Maguires, for instance, leap straight from academy into first team. And those that don't, they get a better development experience playing in championship for another club because it can be made to work. Then, it's not really for me to say, well, actually, that's wrong. You know, actually need to play in reserve. One of the issues with reserve is that not everybody took it seriously. So yeah, I can remember results where, you know, one club would beat another by 90 and they'd be playing on, you know, a park pitch somewhere because you can't get access to some of the multi-site grounds, you know, if you, and I'm not particularly mentioning one club.
Well, football grounds.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
So you then, so it's not just that, it's the whole package around running reserves. You know, I have a personal fondness for it, but that doesn't mean to say that it's right for everybody. And I think that, you know, the lead stance on this is that their players get a better development experience playing at Featherstone or at Hunslet.
But they're probably the big winner in it. They've got it.
No,
right. Not everyone else has got that link up.
Well, they've the opportunity of that link up, and then the other side of the hill, you've got, you know, Saints and Wigan and Warrington have all had development relationships with the Swintons of this world. Swinton just played at the weekend and won a fixture against Oldham and had the benefit of two Wigan players, effectively. So, you know, one way or the other, those clubs, I would agree that at the outposts, you know, Cumbria, for instance, you know, not many people are queuing up to partner with Cumbria because it involves a three-hour journey each way. So I know it's not perfect, but the key point here is what's best for the player. What's best for the player? You might think, you know, I might think I know, Phil might think he knows, Gary certainly does know, but fundamentally, what's best for the player? And some players would rather play as low at Featherstone at Unslet than playing in a reserve grade that might not be as intense.
That's at the elite level. What about the community level? There seems to be a significant drop off at under 16s at the moment. We're told that there's only a couple of clubs in Castleford now that have under 16s. What are we doing about retaining the talent underneath the elite level?
There isn't just a significant drop off at under. There has always been a drop off between 14 and 18. In fact, it's 12 to 18, and that's because maturation rates kick in there. Players get what is fun and enjoyable up to under 11s when it's intended to be. That becomes a little bit more serious. Some lads grow a bit quicker and stronger and tougher, and there's also a little bit of self-selection. Some of the teams that are trying to be champions all of a sudden weed out players that they don't think are good enough. There's lots of different factors at work, and we're looking at how 12s to 18s is structured to try and take out of it some of that selection to retain more of what we've got under 12, up to 12, to keep the fun there, to keep people engaging the sport more often.
Scott? Are we fishing in the right areas, though? I mean, do we now need to do more in the London and the South and look at not even rugby union players, but other athletes? Do we need to develop Ireland, Scotland, where we're getting more of a World Cup presence with these nations? Do we have to fish in different waters?
And I think we do. I mean, one of the things we had timetable this year, but it fell away because of other things, was to do an Irish talent camp, you know, just to, and actually bring people over for a weekend, televise it, put it out on a streaming process, and give people a chance, get some ex legends of the game to go and
absolutely
do some to work with them, and
he'd love to. He's keen.
No, we've
Monday nights is available,
yeah.
Nigel.
6 to 8.
Yeah, 6 to 8 if you could. Maybe 5:30 to
Aberdeen
half 8.
Would be good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You were a big fan of the old A team. You would have had Grix in the A team this week, wouldn't you? But seriously, no. I'm joking aside. A team.
Yeah.
If you were in Nigel's position, would you be looking to try and push this through?
Yes, I would. Yeah. And then I say, and I know we talk with this show registration now, but I feel as though players want to be part of their own club, putting the colours on, you know, like in our days it was a Thursday night, so whatever day they want to come up from there. And now I don't with the dual registration, for me, I'm not into it. I don't think it works. I don't think it brings a development on for the players. I feel as though that they would want to be part of their own club, playing in the club colours from there every week. And I say, if form and injuries coming from there, they know all the sisters from there, rather than being shelved out to another club. And also, with this dual red, and I say with some players, do they feel wanted in the opposition, in the dressing room, where they're going, whether they go to Featherstone or whether they go to Swinton, all this sort of thing. I don't think it serves its purpose, and they're better off staying with their own clubs. And I say, for mine, everybody should be made to have a reserve team. It's as simple as that. It is. And, we are losing too many at 19 years of age because they are being told, you're not going to be good enough. You ain't going to be good enough to be a Super League player. But as we all know, some players take a little bit more time to develop, and maybe from. I know myself from Alex Walmsley. I had Alex in 2010 when I took him to South Africa with Bala, and he was told, no, you've missed the boat because you're 19 years of age, you've not been part of an academy, you're too late. And I tell you, I told Cass and I told Hull and I told Leeds about him. You know, they said, oh no, because he's not been in an academy, he's 19 years of age, it's too late. boy, oh boy, Alex Walmsley, he's going to be a star in the World Cup. Simple as that. Mm-hmm. Oh, by the way, well done, Alex. Congratulations on being a dad.
Yeah,
I tell you what, he showed some enthusiasm and commitment, didn't he?
Substituted himself and turned up in the hospital in his kit.
Hey, do you know what Scott Griggs had been thinking? I tell you what, if Alex Walmsley were running for that ball, he'd have got kicked out. He wouldn't have died, didn't he? He was on his way to hospital.
Yeah. I tell you what, Mark's thing's really glad that Scott Griggs missed that ball.
Going back to the development areas and talent, there's some speculation about how League One might look with some of the footprint clubs that have been put in over the last few years in the southern part of the country, who aren't getting the crowds and perhaps haven't developed in the way that you would have hoped they would. Is there a worry that we've lost an opportunity with the likes of Oxford and Gloucestershire and Hemel?
There isn't a worry for me, because, you know, I think that I think every position in the league, there's got to be a return on that, and I don't mean that disrespectfully to anybody. But if you know, the game hasn't got unlimited resources. We talk about reintroducing reserve grades, and well, then if you want to do that, and if you want to impose it on a club, then they'll say, well, that's fine, give us the money to do it. You know, you need to give us the money to do it. Well, that has to come from somewhere. There's not bottomless pits, and I think that what's important is not where the clubs are located, but they need to be playing in front. They need to be generating something on behalf of the sport that's not just 17 players on a Sunday afternoon. And then, you know, there was one example this year, and it was raised at a club meeting, so I'm not being indiscreet here, where Herman were playing Huntslet, and we had three buses going down at the game, and a bus of Huntslet players going down, a bus of Huntslet supporters going down, and a bus of Hemel players going down because they've been training at Dewsbury. Well, that's, you know, that ain't right. You know, I can't stand here, and I know, you know, at heart you're a romantic
idealist,
and you want everybody to play everybody and everybody to get whatever they want, and we can all, but it just don't work like that. And I do think we are moving into a phase where we're saying, you know what, if you are going to have the privilege and benefit of scarce central resources, there's going to have to be a return on investment. You're going to have to. One of the big things that we're working on before the World Cup is, you know, a direct membership scheme for the sport, because we, you know, that's part of the broadcast planning environment, and to give people a behind scenes look at what's going on in the World Cup. So we're going to have some footage there, and people, well, it's not, we're not charging for this, it's just going to be part of adding value for supporters. And I think it's not unreasonable to say to an Oxford, well, it's great that you're playing there, but what actual tangible benefit is happening as a consequence? Are you sat on top of a pyramid of players that are playing the sport in the county that wouldn't otherwise play? Or have you reaching out to a number of people that wouldn't otherwise be engaged with rugby league? Or are you providing some commercial revenues into the sport? There has to, everybody, you know, has got to be accountable effectively. And one of them would be, you know, how many people are bothered if you don't exist? That's the litmus test. The litmus test for any professional club is how many people are bothered if you don't exist. And if nobody's bothered or not enough people are bothered, then that's your answer.
But don't you have to give it time? Because the history of the sport would say that if it's top down, it's never worked. If it's grassroots up, it has a chance. Grassroots up might take 15, 20, 25 years.
And the reason the sport put four teams in League One was because it recognised that trying to put Celtic Crusaders in a division and expecting them to swim in a fully professional league was not a good use of resources. They did win the way through, by the way, just to be clear, they weren't just parachuted in. But fundamentally, I don't want Oxford to stop playing. I absolutely want Oxford to carry on playing. What I don't want to do is to burn off loads of the game's scarce resources trying to artificially prop up something.
Also as well, Nigel, I'd say the massive hotbed for rugby league, and, you know, I know because I go up there quite regularly, I'm up there for the next 2 weeks up in Cumbria, yeah. You know, and certainly if they get quality rugby league, as has been proved in the World Cup of the Four Nations, yeah. You know, the Cumbrians will watch Cumbria rugby league, so... And at this moment in time, it's very, very, very disappointing. Certainly from a professional point of view, the amateur game seems to be getting more people watching than what the pro clubs do. So would there be any opportunity whatsoever? Let's just say Roman Abramovich says, hey, you know, in his Russian voice, you know, I've heard that this Cumbrian, I want to bring a Super League team in. Would ever a Super League club in Cumbria be considered again? Would it be considered?
Well,
because we all know the hotbed, what it's got, but from there.
If one, two or three of the clubs win their way through the pyramid, then they're in. They don't have to be considered. There's no kind of giant hand coming through and picking them out and plucking them and putting them in there. There was a Cumbrian club, people forget, there was a Cumbrian club in Super League, Workington, and they played in front of 3,000-4,000 people. The challenge, I think, for Cumbria is not just whether you kind of merge Workington and Whitehead and those kind of things. It's are there enough people to actually sustain a club. You know, we've got on a full-time basis, in a nutshell, the basic economics of the sport are that if you want to be in the Super League and a sustainable club in the Super League, you need to be playing in front of 10,000 people. That's roughly what it is. And if you're not playing in front of 10,000 people, a hard-working chairman, you know, a Michael Carter of this world or somebody else, is having to put in a shortfall to make good that. You know, that's what it is. So the question would be, you know, what could a Super League club in Cumbria generate? And let's say it could be 5,000. That could be 5,000. Right. In the long run, that wouldn't be enough to allow that club to spend at salary cap level, which is what you need to do to be sustainable. So somebody else has to prop that up, has to make that shortfall up.
As Cool Cash is doing at Salford, obviously, because he's not getting crowds anyway, is he?
Well, clearly he's had to put an awful lot of money in.
OK, let's get a quick round up social media.
Yeah, speaking of Salford and people talking about attendances, 1,400 at the game on Saturday. Lots of talk about that at the weekend, although having seen them play the week before, I'm not surprised. Though that few, I'm surprised they weren't even less for a game which had nothing riding on it whatsoever.
Not really.
No. People asking, attendances, are we happy with the attendance at Wembley this year? Obviously, the first year in which Club Wembley have been sold by ourselves rather than just taken as a given this year.
What do you reckon, Wembley? How did you view that crowd?
I viewed it as disappointing but understandable. It's not any different really from where it was the year before. I don't have the precise numbers year on year. It looked a lot better because we managed to position the seats in a much more advantageous way. That event, we all would like an extra 10,000 or 20,000 people to that event, and that goes without saying. One of the issues for the sport is, of course, we've created another Wembley magic, which is everybody here has waxed lyrical about how good that is in the early part of summer. And in addition, we've put a Toulouse trip in and we've put a Toronto trip in or a Catalan trip in. And so we've got to understand about things in the round. But the heritage of the Challenge Cup is the single biggest attraction to most people that play. I mean, they all want to play for the country, the young players, and they do want grand final rings. But I think Gary will tell you that walking out and winning at Wembley ranks number one in terms of what they'd like to achieve. And not just young British players, by the way, the Australians do as well. So we've all got a duty to nurture the Challenge Cup. It's not one person's particular problem, it's everybody's problem. We used to have busloads of people. I was talking to one club chairman recently, who a man I respect an awful lot and runs a championship club, who said, you know, they're taking less this year than last year. When I asked him why, he hadn't got a good answer. You know, and you know, when you look at, say, Rugby Union, you know, they would sell their big events out like that through their club network. So I think it does need some help, and we're determined to give it some help. It's still a wonderful, wonderful event, and the game's got too few blue ribbon events, real jaw-droppingly good showcase events. Live on terrestrial television, by the way, so it's a great opportunity to showcase everything. And we've actually had the last two finals have been terrific. You know, I think it's fair to say we waited for a cliffhanger for 9 years, but then, or 8 years or whatever it was, but then we get two in two. So, you know, we do have to really embrace it and nurture it.
Do we need to make that a doubleheader? Is there a possibility of getting at least two more clubs' fans there, perhaps reintroducing something like the old Northern Rail Cup?
Well, not if you want to keep the schoolboys under 13 finalists. Again, people have to make these decisions, because you can't open a venue like Wembley for 10 hours. It's just prohibitively expensive. It's too long to do that. So you would have to, if you wanted to play two matches there, you'd have to let the schoolboys go.
Okay, fair dues. Is it going to stay at Wembley, the Challenge Cup?
Well, there's a discussion going on, and we did have a 20-year staging agreement, but elements of it got changed after 10 years, which was the debentures, which is why we have... it was a very advantageous deal, so we're just going through the negotiation with Wembley to make sure that the pencil's been sharpened as much as it can be.
It's got to stay there, Nigel, surely. It's got to do. It's the best cup competition in World Rugby League. It's got to stay there, hasn't it? It's got to do. As we say, you know, everybody wants to play at Wembley, whether you're homebred or Australia, New Zealand, Papua New Guinea.
We just have to make sure the deal's right, Gary. That's the important thing. And that means allowing the people that are trying to do that deal to at least put some jeopardy and doubt in the mind of the people you're negotiating with.
Marketing. This is something a lot of people are asking. It seems we never get told how much anything's worth. It feels like we're giving things away on the cheap. The store-bought deal obviously jumps to the mind, but it always says it's commercially sensitive, we don't tell anything. Should we not be shouting out that we've got a new sponsor or a record sponsor for this or that or whatever? I don't know.
Well, I think we do. I mean, we don't say it's, you know, £5.63 or whatever. We don't go down to that level. But I do think when we say, you know, I think it's right that we don't have to say precisely what it is. We'd say it's six figures or seven figures or whatever it is. That, I don't think that's marketing, but that's commercial sales. And I think that on the whole, our commercial portfolio has been pretty strong over the last few years. I think there was a difficulty when the credit crunch hit the whole of the economy in 2008, 9 and 10 and the ramifications from that. But I think that on the whole, we've recovered that. There's good sponsors, quality sponsors across all of the properties. There's no vacancies. And I think that as we move into 2018 and 19, that portfolio will be strong again.
In terms of marketing, we had the League of the Extraordinary in 2013, one of the best campaigns I think we've put together. But like so often, we did it for a very short period of time. Yeah. And I know that video was expensive to produce, but it almost hints at there's something else coming, and it never did. Is that the fault of our marketing, that we don't put together a plan that maybe lasts 3 or 4 years and actually position the brand somewhere?
No, I think everybody's got an opinion on marketing without, you know, quite necessarily knowing what it is. I trust our director of marketing and his team to do the best for the sport. The big issue for us is not necessarily, you know, whether we have caricatures or what we've got. Is the big issue for us now is to make sure that we develop the membership offer so that we actually begin to talk more directly with our kind of support base.
And is there a danger that you're only preach to the converted, though?
No, because there isn't, because I think we reach wider than that. Our big showpiece events do reach wider than that, and, you know, there is some insight that the people of the total population that's got some interest in rugby league, I saw somewhere in this country, was about 12 million. Now, we don't have 12 million people turning up to us, and we've got to reach those people and talk to those people, and our digital offer over the course of the next few years is intended to try and do that.
Do we do that more through celebrity endorsement, perhaps? Is that an area that we haven't embraced enough? We've got a lot of friends.
I think we do, and we get them. You know, we get some there. You know, Russell Crowe comes when we try to get him here. You know, we get other people that are interested. We'd always, if you're asking me, would I like the Royal Box at Wembley to look like the Royal Box at Wimbledon? The answer is yes, of course I would. But, you know, so
do you have to change the date of the final to do that? Because an August bank holiday weekend is inconvenient for a lot of people.
Look, that's one of the things that's being looked at, but, you know, whether or not that's the determinant factor is a different issue. You know, I think that if people want to come to the final, we'll come to the final. I think our challenge as administrators and the general sport is to talk it up a bit more and not to keep finding fault with it and to actually say this is a great spectacle. Everybody who went to the Wembley final just was purring about it afterwards, and, you know, goodness me, can we just actually celebrate that instead of saying, well, shouldn't we have had somebody else there, and why wasn't that fellow there?
Well, as I say also as well, though, Nigel, we talk about rugby league, and it is, and I don't think we're being biased here when we say rugby league is the best product out there, best product sport out there for sure. And when we talk about brands, and as I say, we mentioned it in the first hour, bringing Great Britain back, and what great would be for the brand of Great Britain to come back, and I say the Kangaroos are coming over, and I mentioned it on the show a couple of weeks ago, where it would be total sellouts from there. Where is it, you know, a proper Kangaroo tour? Well, I don't really think it would be where they'll go to Halifax and they'll go to Wollongong and the thing, but bringing it back against the county sides. Yeah. The Kangaroos play 3 test matches, and then on a Wednesday night, you know, Yorkshire, coached by Lee Radford, Lancashire, coached by Sean Wayne, and Cumbria, that would pack it again up there by Paul Cleary. And we talk about with the marketing and the product, what we've got, surely that'd be a sellout, wouldn't it?
Look, I'd love to, I'm the same age.
But what I'm saying from a national point of view, on terrestrial television, that would be great for us, wouldn't it?
I'll answer the question. I remember the tours like you do, and I'd love to see full tours. The clubs are going to incubation now. It's not when we had tours in the past, we were running seasons that were opposite, so that you could drop the Kangaroos in and you could play Wednesday night and know that the teams
were also there. As well, Nigel, can't the club be told, hey, listen, this is what's happening. This is what's happening. Where are the governing body here? This is what's happening because it's for the good of the game.
The truth of the matter is, A, it's not that straightforward, and B, the Kangaroos don't necessarily want to play an 8-game tour. You know, we've had all on to trying to get there was a collective bargaining agreement still being settled in Australia, which, and this is one of the issues about the success and the profile of Origin. They call that they treat that as an international. So they have a limit under their CBA how many international stroke Origins their leading players are going to play over an 8-year cycle. When you take two World Cups out and then you take an annual test match out against New Zealand, you're left with a very short number. And that's why just getting the Kangaroos over to do it was no mean feat. I would love them to play in Cumbria and Yorkshire and Lancashire and everywhere else against emerging England, and I'd very happily have an 8-game or 10-game tour Wednesday weekend, and I'm trying to make that happen in reverse when the Lions go down in 19. That volume of match.
Because we've seen, as I say, when we look at the other code, what response they get, don't you? When we look at the other code, you look at the fans there and the interest. Again, from our point of view, because obviously we want to smash the Aussies, we want to bring the old Ashes back, and I say we want to do in the World Cup. But I tell you, for our product and for our brand, certainly, absolutely, because it was one of the worst things that's ever done to the game when Richard Lewis got rid of our great brain from there. But bringing it back in 2019, the product and the brand, I think it's a no-brainer, to be honest with you.
International Rugby League, in my opinion, represents a great opportunity for the sport.
Yeah, it is, absolutely.
To put more windows,
and if you're going to go to a dance, you have to have somebody to dance with.
To put more international windows in, which I know with the other hats you wear in the international and European scheme, how do you do that with the number of domestic games that we play? Do we need to reduce the number to fit in more internationals?
You'd have to have international opposition, Phil. We just said, people can't fly around the world and play midweek and come back and have a sensible cup. We put a weekend in this in 2018 to provide for an international window. We have to remember that whatever the income is of the sport, whatever that is, it's 97% generated by the club game. That's where the value is generated. So you've got to allow the clubs a chance to earn an income to pay the players, and that's unlike rugby union, unlike cricket, unlike soccer. So to a large extent, you have to work collaboratively with the clubs to deliver a compelling calendar that gives the internationals some space, but gives the clubs some chance to grow as well.
We also mentioned duty of care at the beginning of the discussion. Is 30 games a season every season too much in terms of duty of care? Is making Hull play 5 days after the Challenge Cup final duty of care? Is two Easter weekends, which was an exception this year, duty of care?
It was an exception. You've just answered it. It was an exception.
Is it still duty of care?
Well, look, I think that the five-day turnaround is something that the sport has embraced. I think that we have to make compromises all the way down the line. The reality is that we've got a television product to sell, and we need to be selling it at a time that it's demanded.
Okay, where do you see the sport being then, Nigel, in 5 years? What are we going to be looking at?
You told me this wasn't an interview for a job.
People want to know what your vision is. Where are we going? What can we look forward to?
What the sport needs to achieve, what we want to achieve, is more viewers, more spectators, and more participants at all level. I'd like to see fuller stadium, better stadium. I'd like to see a winning international side and a vibrant international calendar. I think that the churn that's going on with Castleford's emergence is part of a good programme. I think it's good that we're getting clubs winning trophies. If we can play in front of 75% full facilities and we've got outstanding on-field entertainment, probably a slightly simplified version so that we're not all getting confused about various rules and regulations. And I think internationally it's important that we continue to develop and make sure that the World Cup in 2021 is the single biggest breakthrough tournament that the sport can put on.
Okay, good stuff. We will go around the room then for our predictions this weekend. Scott, did any Widnes fans get in touch with you this week?
No, they've all gone quiet, the Widnes fans. And I'll tell you what, to be honest with you, because why not? Boy, oh boy, aren't they boring to watch? And do you know what? Dennis is a good friend of mine.
He's not ringing you.
And, and they've signed somebody from St George at Lawarraco. Is it
Will Matthews? Matthews
from St George. He's only played once this year, but a quote from Dennis is, he's big and he runs the ball up strong. Well, I could get 120 less, but I'll do that job. to be honest with you, you know, from there. But
yeah, we can't 120 players on the pitch. The ref will notice. They don't notice everything, but they'll notice.
No, the Widnes fans all of a sudden have gone quiet. I wonder why, you Widnes fans.
Right, we've got three live games this week. Hull, Wakefield on Thursday. Leeds, Salford, Friday. And on Sunday, could be the biggest game of the weekend. Wigan, Castleford. Right, let's go around the room then. Scoy, Hull, Wakefield. Well, there's no need to ask you. Wakefield have given up. They've declared that's it. They've got 30. That'll do for them.
Simple answer, Hull by 16.
OK. Nigel, are you going to give us a prediction?
Well, I hope the best side wins.
Right, yeah, we'll move on.
We don't sit on the fence.
I understand why you think Wakefield's season's finished, but I'm not sure I agree with you, but I just hope it's a thrilling encounter.
Right.
In front of a packed stadium.
I think Hull's dynamic has changed with the defeat against Wigan this week, so I think it is do or die for Hull, and I think they'll just prevail.
Well, I thought Liam Watson was going to be banned, so I built all my thoughts on that, but I've got to go Wakefield by 8.
Yeah, I'm going to go Wakefield, so we split.
Honestly, give us the butter. Oh, Michael, I'll spread your bread for you. I'll spread the butter on the bread. Absolute bonkers, Mark Wilson.
Okay.
Do me a
what
favour.
As it was when Castleford...
Do me a,
yeah,
do
all right.
Me
we'll
a
move
favour.
On, we'll move on. We'll proceed directly to the qualifiers. Widnes London. Must win for London if they're going to have any chance.
Yeah, must win for London, but I'd say Widnes as well. It's a must win for them, isn't it? It's as simple as that. If they want to try and avoid that £1 million game from there. But yeah, London will go there with plenty of confidence. They won't be intimidated, but I just go, have they got enough quality, Widnes? But yeah, they'll grind out a win. There's nothing attractive to them whatsoever. They'll grind out a win. I'll go Widnes by 7. A boring Widnes win.
Widnes are suffering a few injuries too many at the moment. I think they've got a couple now that won't play again this season. The pressure is on them now. London can play with the abandon of knowing that if they get the win, they're in with a chance of the £1 million game. I'll just go for Widnes very narrowly on their pitch.
Why not? London by 2.
Yeah, I'm going to go London in that one. I said Widnes to get relegated, so I need them to lose if that's going to happen.
The Widnes fans now be on Twitter saying, oh, no, he's not predicted us. I don't have any influence on the way you play.
No. Hulkar, Catalan. Have Hulkar been in the pub all week?
Yeah, Hulkar will be celebrating, won't they? And they'd say Catalans are desperate. I wouldn't imagine Tim Sheens have arrested a few of the guys. You know, they'll still be slinging the Guinness down or the lager, whatever they're drinking. So the Catalans, yeah, I'm just going to go Hulkar arrest a few people. I'll go for Catalans to win this one by 8.
Castellan are pretty horrible to watch at the moment, which is not nice, as in the last few years they've been one of the entertainers. It will mean more to them, obviously. Tim Sheens will want to preserve the record of going unbeaten through the qualifiers. If Catalan don't score early, Hulkar will win.
Rich?
Hulkar.
Yeah, I'm going Hulkar as well in that one. And Wigan against Castleford, live on Sunday.
Tasty. Very, very tasty game. But if Hardaker and Roberts doesn't play, and as I say, you know, they've lost between the two coaches. I tell you what, that'd be a Great Britain coaching partnership, wouldn't it? Daryl Powell, attack coach, and Sean Wayne, the angry defensive coach. They'll rip it in the wazzits, don't worry about that. But Wigan are desperate, aren't they? Wigan are loving this. I'm going Wigan just by 4.
Next time they meet after this would only be the grand final. I think Castleford can't do what they did last week, and that is take their foot off the gas when they're in control. I think they need to hit full throttle now coming up to a semi-final. I'm going Cass.
Style clash, Cass.
Yeah, Castleford
for me. You know
what,
boys? This is the grand final. Cass and Wigan, grand final. Oh. You've heard it from the legend.
So who's going to miss out then? We've got 2 minutes. Who's missing out on the 4? Well, we know 2 of them. Who's the other 2?
The 4 is going to be it's Cass, Leeds, Hull and Wigan. That's 4.
I think Hull will remain in the 4. I think it could come down to Wigan against Wakefield in the very final round. And I wouldn't back against Wakefield at Bellevue, even though they're obviously not going to win another game this season.
No. At the Beaumont Legal Stadium, I'd be going for Wakefield. Michael Carter's listening, so we've got to get it right. You're banned from having chip butties, by the way, Scott.
Good.
So that's bad news for you there.
Good.
Why, what for? What for being honest?
Yeah. Hull and Wakefield.
Hull and
so Wakefield
I don't
know how that'll happen.
That's why I said
draw.
Listen, we're not a loving programme, as you know. We're not a loving. We tell it as it is. Do me a favour, you two.
We've been told.
Honestly,
off.
We're not a loving programme.
Well, we've been told.
Let's
already.
All fall in. Let's all fall in love with Wakefield.
Well,
do me a favour.
You know what? The millions listening at home on the downloading the podcast as I do every week will be hoping that Wakefield win this week just to shut you up. It'll be well
worth
it.
What's the odds on Scott Grix, Harry Sunderland?
Yeah, well, last time he criticised Sneed, he got hat-trick, so we'll have a bit on Gricks for that. You've got to be quiet now, Scotty. No right to reply.
I'm going to be quiet. I tell you what, I'm more chance of winning Alex Sunderland, Scott Gricks. There you go.
We'll see. That's it. Nigel, thank you for coming in. I know we've probably not made everyone happy at home because there's only two. It goes pretty quick, but you've fronted up to everything we've asked you, so we can only thank you for coming in.
Well, thank you.
You're more than welcome any time. You know that. You made a nice cup of tea. Thanks to Scoey. Thanks to Phil. Thanks to Rich. Thanks to you for listening at home. If you listen to the podcast, we're giving away 4 tickets to one of the semi-finals. Make sure you download it. That's us done for another week.